Mike wrote the definitive paper on the emergency treatment of alcoholics in the emergency room. His contribution, we could spend the rest of the morning talking about Mike's alone. Mike is an extremely beautiful person. He has been extremely important in my recovery and my family's recovery. I'm very grateful to Mike. Mike has many talents, and one of which is he always leaves something to be finished, a reason to come back. When my wife Annie and I took Mike to the plane after he spoke at our anniversary dinner for our unit, he was in the midst of discussing his trip to a nudist colony in France, and he left a lot to be said, and he'll be back to finish it, I'm sure, particularly if my wife has her way. So I would like to, with great pleasure, give you a dear friend and friend of everybody in this room, Dr. Max Wiseman.
I guess that's a warm feeling that overwhelms me when I hear such unwarranted introductions indirectly by Joe that unnerved me to begin with, and then by Bill, that I really don't know what to say immediately. I can't very well get up before you like many of you and say, my name is Max Wiseman, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. But I can, after having been called up to the platform a number of years ago at an IDAA meeting on a Saturday night during the banquet, and was surprised to be given an award, a beautiful silver cup with an inscription on the bottom that said, almost one of us. I can at least get up and say, I'm Max Wiseman, almost one of you. And I'm very proud of that. I really don't have to take any time to warm you up or to wake you up after that beautiful talk with that amazingly clear and thought-provoking parable that Joe Cruz left with us. What I want to do is, I don't even have to stand here and sort of do this and kind of set the stage. What I really want to do is to plunge directly into a problem that faced me when Jay and the committee informed me that I was to speak at this meeting. And I said, oh, great, I really love that. But they pulled a curve because usually what that means is you just get up and say what it was like before and what you did about it and how it's like now. And I'm always ready and grateful for the opportunity to talk about how I was involved in the field of alcoholism and what I did to learn something about it by going to AA meetings regularly and consistently, and then what I'm doing now as a result of it. And so it doesn't require any preparation at all. But when I realized that I was to speak on prevention, pipe dream or possibility, and then I couldn't say no, and I never do say no, when AA asked me to do something, well, I'd do it, as all of you do, fortunately. But I wondered what to talk about and what sort of content should be in. And of course, as usual, I kept procrastinating and doing nothing about it until a few days ago when I got panicky. And can you hear me back there? And so I went to the library and asked for a computer search of the literature, collating three things: prevention, alcoholism, and physicians. And almost nothing came back. I was lucky that John Henry gave me a copy of his paper on the prevention of physician impairment. That was one of the very few things in the computer search. So I told the librarian, just compare the two, prevention and alcoholism. And then I got back quite a large number of things, and I want to share those with you. It was a whole, you know, and reams and reams of things. And as I looked them over, ran down the titles, I saw that most of them were not really appropriate. But I checked off quite a large number that were, and frankly, I didn't go through all of them by yesterday, but I did read about 27 papers. And the more I read, the more fascinated I was, and I realized that there was a lot that needs to be thought about, and a lot, certainly, that needs to be written to get into the computer to share with those of us who should be concerned about prevention and alcoholism. Let me share with you, then, some of the things that came out of the quick survey of the literature that I did. Incidentally, last night on the bus, or shortly thereafter, after we came back, Ken Williams gave me a copy of a little monograph, Services to Alcoholic Children, that he had participated in a symposium that reports the papers and the discussion. I found that an extremely interesting and well worthwhile series of papers that didn't get dredged out in the collation of alcoholism and prevention, but I want to refer to that and recommend it to all of you, if you can get hold of a copy of it, to read it. One of the things that I simply want to put the material together and present to you that I learned was that one can really think of three approaches to the problem of prevention of alcoholism. One was characterized by the research in Finland, the Finnish scientists, Ketil Brunn and a number of others, and the Canadian researchers, Schmidt and DeLint, developed the thesis that the incidence of alcoholism is closely correlated, directly correlated, with alcohol consumption. And they went through, you know, it's something that most of us have learned from personal experience, but that doesn't count when it's just a gut reaction. You need scientific proof for it. And lo and behold, they came up with some beautiful data. During Prohibition years, there was really a reduction in alcoholism. A lot of other things increased with bootlegging and so on. But the difficulty of getting the stuff, the lack of availability, and therefore the reduction in consumption in spite of moonshine was correlated with the incidence of liver cirrhosis, the reduction in the rate of liver cirrhosis, which is an index of the rate of alcoholism. They also pointed to the worldwide consumption and during war times when lots of alcohol was diverted toward munitions and other activities, and it was restricted in sale and availability, alcoholism and the problems related with it took a sharp dip. So that kind of philosophy, which might be called the control philosophy, has a number of correlations with things one can do to reduce alcoholism, such things as increase in taxation. And that's been attempted in some, in all states we tax alcoholic beverages, but periodically there are arguments to increase taxation in order to reduce the level of alcoholism. We control advertising. It's no longer possible to advertise distilled spirits on television, public television, although beer is still advertised, and wine. But if one can remove advertising from newspapers, from all kinds of public media, the theory is that alcoholism can be prevented in that way. We regulate and control the number of outlets, the number of liquor stores, the number of bars. We control the hours of sale and the hours of consumption. Bars have to close at a certain time, etc. They have to be a certain distance from schools, and etc. So we do think of some measures to prevent alcoholism based on this control idea. And I can remember that the NIAAA came out with a list of its priorities when Ernie Noble was the director, and one of the very first priority, the highest priority, was to support all measures in this country that would stabilize the per capita consumption. I think at the time it was 2.3 gallons of booze of all kinds, you know, equated in absolute alcohol, beer, wine, and hard liquor. And Ernie came out with the priority that we should stabilize consumption at the level of 2 point whatever it was. Well, he presented this first to a task force, to a national coalition of adequate alcoholism programs. I was representing the American Medical Society on alcoholism on it. And immediately I thought, gee, that won't work. And so I got up and I said, Ernie, and we were very good friends, I said, I'm opposed to that first priority. I think it should be worded differently. I really think you're barking up the wrong tree, because if our programs to treat alcoholics, that is the secondary prevention and the tertiary prevention, not the primary prevention about which we knew nothing at the time, but if our programs to treat alcoholics are successful, and all of those programs that were successful were based on abstinence, it would mean that alcoholics, who we know consume, they're very heavy drinkers, and only about 6% of the population consumes 50% of the alcohol in this country, and another 10%, making a total of 16%, consumes 25% more, 16% consumes therefore 75% of the alcohol manufactured and sold in this country. If we're successful, we're going to have a fall in consumption across the country. So if you're interested, and we have to support programs to stabilize consumption at that level, it means that people like myself, non-alcoholics, who drink relatively little, and millions of other Americans who drink infrequently or moderately, will have to increase their consumption. Just logic. And you create a whole new pool for the creation of alcoholics. And I didn't want to lend myself to it. Well, Ernie was angry with me. He thought that at least with my presence there, he'd get some support. I was the only doctor there. And you'd be amazed how emotional and how political such proposals are, because almost immediately, and naturally, the liquor interests in that national coalition also opposed that notion to stabilize the per capita consumption. Where would their profits be? They had a rise every year. I was asked, since when have you gone into the pay of the liquor interest by many of my friends, actually. So you can see how confusing this control business can be and how contradictory sometimes it is. Nevertheless, there has been a great deal of concern and evidence that possibly if we do, and my idea was that Ernie should change the wording to not to stabilize it, but to reduce the consumption in this country. Then I could easily be for it, and of course the liquor industry realized what I was driving at, and I haven't been a very good friend to the representatives of liquor, beer, and wine on that coalition, even though on the surface we are. Well, that whole development in the field of alcoholism to control and limit production and consumption has a great deal to be said for it, and I want to refer to it later. But the second set of theories about the prevention of alcoholism points out that it's not alcohol that's responsible for alcoholism, and there's no point in controlling anything about the manufacture or sale or even the consumption of liquor, because we don't use that approach in public health programs to other diseases. We don't try to control diabetes by limiting the manufacture or consumption of sugar. So the analogy is, that's nonsense. You don't want to deal with alcohol at all. But the cause of alcoholism is not in the bottle, but in the person. And this sort of philosophy is extremely widespread. Even among us who are working in the field of alcoholism, the bulk of our programs, treatment programs and prevention programs, are devoted to concern with the individual. Because the theory is that it's in the personality problems, the conflicts in the development of personality, that alcoholism is really rooted. That it's possibly in the metabolism of individuals. It's some constitutional defects that we have to be concerned with. Maybe genetic counseling and concerns with the metabolism, which is controlled by genes, the enzyme system. So that most of the research and the programs to prevent alcoholism have been revolving around this second set of theories. And of course, the proposals are concerned in prevention mechanisms with increasing knowledge of yourself, increasing knowledge of the nature of the disease, what the metabolism of alcohol is like, and how to intervene in the metabolism. We're concerned with attitudes in children and adolescents and adults, with beliefs, the social and cultural, the stigma that Joe was talking about, and the behavior that's affected by it, the withdrawal or the failure to admit, the denial mechanism, all of these things, if we can work in this area, we might make a dent in the incidence of alcoholism. Well, this is a whole set of programs developing. So we have drink driving programs, with a lot of education and classes involved there. Maybe we should teach the public and everybody to limit yourself to one or two drinks at a cocktail party and have attitudes developed that if anybody at a party drinks more than one or two, well, you'd be frowned upon. And in certain cultures, that's certainly true, that any sign of intoxication is anathema. I was brought up, as most of you know, in an Orthodox Jewish home where it was perfectly all right to drink at a Passover meal, Friday night, in the warmth of my family environment. You just drink one or two goblets of wine, or you sip your father's kümmel. But getting drunk was characteristic not of us good Jews, but of those Irishmen in the next ghetto, you see. And no self-respecting Jew would want to be seen drunk because somebody might mistake him for one of them. And when I went to China 2 years ago, I was astonished to find very much the same kind of an attitude, partially because people live so closely that the three-generation and four-generation family living in one small apartment is an influence on everybody, especially the older people frown on the younger people getting disruptive, unruly, and so on. And people just don't get drunk, by and large, with rare exceptions. So that maybe that would really prevent the problem of the problems of alcoholism rearing their ugly heads. Maybe a physiological feedback mechanism to encourage people to recognize the physiological phenomena that occur with one too many, and then to, with this kind of awareness, become more aware of the effects of intoxication, maybe people will react appropriately. The Education Commission of the States, which was a group of very distinguished people, including a representative from the executive director of the National Council on Alcoholism and many other social agencies, got together and they developed a program for the prevention of alcoholism, and they published this monograph. Well, when some of us in the NCA read it, we were appalled because you may remember the net effect was that they were going to encourage responsible drinking. Well, some of us ask, what is responsible drinking anyway? Is there any responsible drinking when you're an alcoholic? The answer, of course, is no. And in a certain sense, there is no responsible drinking. The work of Charlie Lieber pointed out that even one martini, when he took biopsies of his medical students before and after, the team found that from the biopsies and the slides of the liver that one martini produces fatty droplet degeneration in the liver. So is that responsible drinking if you know that? Obviously, those of us who are still drinking, who are not alcoholics as yet, must make some kind of decision about whether or not we want to continue with this kind of activity. So it's not responsible drinking that's up for grabs, but responsible decisions about drinking. Because if the liver the next day recovers, well, you might be justified, if you wanted certain other effects of the alcohol, you might be justified in taking the risk of further damage. But it's not responsible drinking at all. So that slogan leaves a great deal to be desired. Well, maybe there is a possibility when you see the polarization in this country between these two schools of thought that one, it's the alcohol, the demon rum, that's responsible for alcoholism, and the other, that alcohol has nothing to do with it. It's really in the human being. And when you see the conflicts and the struggles between the two, maybe we can recognize that there's something in both philosophies. That maybe if we combine the two rationally and understandably and look upon it as a risk-taking phenomenon, that everybody takes a risk in taking a drink, when you don't know really what your genetics is, whether you've been born with that kind of pilot light which under certain circumstances will flare up into alcoholism, or whether even without such a pilot light, certain other conditions in your body and in the environment. You remember the public health model of the agent, the host, and the environment being the public health model for prevention and treatment programs, maybe a lot more focus on this other aspect should be developed under those circumstances. So it may be both have to be developed. The other model, which is not included in the literature anywhere that I saw in the computer printout, is really a proscriptive approach, which we tried, the whole prohibition movement. Maybe there, and there are many people who want to go back to that, and I don't want to write that off completely. Maybe there is room for a neo-prohibition movement in this country, but maybe with certain safeguards and certain activities that we weren't aware of before in 1919 that maybe could be combined with these other two approaches. Well, let me go ahead and report on an interesting paper I read evaluating the programs that NIAAA supported from 1974 on to 78, 79. Some of you in the audience, like LeClaire and others, perhaps are familiar with this paper. I was not. And it was fascinating to me because I learned that NIAAA, this I knew, of course, from my own work in Maryland, had appropriated about $2.7 million of its budget, which in 1979 was as high as $313 million. So it was less than 1% of its total budget was devoted to supporting prevention programs of one kind or another. And there were approximately 25 of such programs that were funded. 21 of them were evaluated by this team that was funded as part of the prevention program to see how effective these programs were. The others were not evaluated because they didn't respond in the questionnaires that were sent to these 25 or so programs. So 21 of them were really looked into. Some of them had to be thrown out. There were only 17 that were finally evaluated thoroughly. And I must say it was, to my mind, a very thorough kind of evaluation. And lo and behold, they found that only 5 of these programs reported themselves in these questionnaires that they felt they were successful in prevention. The others admitted that the money that had been spent on prevention, with the very as carefully approved as, and we know how careful that is sometimes, approved programs by NIAAA, were shown by their own work to be ineffective. They were failures. Sometimes approved programs by NIAAA were shown by their own work to be ineffective. They were failures. Now, those 5 programs, even, that reported success when they were evaluated, left a great deal to be desired. One of the programs, and I want to mention them because some of you may be familiar with them, one of the programs was the Boys Clubs of America. There were 9 programs there that were very carefully followed up. And the researchers who evaluated them, the success was measured that there was a change in the attitudes, in the beliefs that these kids, these young boys from 9 to 12, I think it was, reported in pre-tests and post-tests. Well, the research has pointed out that there was not necessarily a correlation between the change in attitude and a change in behavior. Now, we know how true that is. Likewise, there were no controls. So you couldn't tell whether these changes in attitudes were a result of the program that these kids had put through, educational programs and various activity programs, etc., or whether they were the result of other factors, a trend of the times, maybe. So there really is no evidence that this program was either successful or unsuccessful, and any kinds of conclusions about replicating this are really unwarranted. Another program that was reported very approvingly in this monograph on services for children of alcoholics was the CASPER program, the Cambridge Somerville program for alcohol rehabilitation, the acronym CASPER. The George Valent has a great deal to do with in Massachusetts. Well, this is really a beautiful program because it involves not only training the public school teachers and not only introducing and developing a curriculum in the school system from the 3rd grade to the 12th grade. We in Maryland, way back in 1968, when our law was passed, I got to the Department of Education and got their willingness to develop a curriculum from kindergarten to the 12th grade. Ours failed, but the CASPER program claims to have been successful. And one of the reasons was that they involved the children themselves, which we hadn't done back in 68. But the CASPER program developed the school kids to be kind of counselors, peer teachers, and discussion leaders. They selected groups of kids to do this, and maybe that was a factor in CASPER's reporting that there was a change in behavior in the children, because indeed there was a change in behavior. Kids reported that they were consuming less. We know the possible dangers in self-reporting, but nevertheless that was done. And of course, they were very extensively involved in community workshops for gatekeepers and the clergy and social service workers in the community. So maybe all of these factors were responsible for their reported success. But even here, the reviewers felt that it wasn't quite valid to conclude that it was a successful program. Let me quote from the evaluation. The evaluators noted that individuals' attitudes surrounding drinking are powerful, deeply embedded, and often culturally determined. And without repeated exposure to experimental learning situations accompanied by positive reinforcement, then old feelings and prejudices will take over. And unfortunately, they found in the CASPER program that with a later post-test, after the period of testing time for this evaluation, that there was a regression to earlier attitudes and earlier destructive behaviors. So that unless we follow up and make this part of our daily living almost, we're going to fail. Let me just mention the Cottage program in Salt Lake City and the King County project in Washington and the University of Massachusetts project for college students. All of these projects left something to be desired by the evaluators, even though they reported success, because of many things. There were no controls, and the methodological shortcomings were pretty obvious. It left a very discouraging feeling. When you look over the failures, it was appalling to me how the people themselves involved in the balance of these programs became discouraged, burnout took place. As soon as you begin to look at things evaluatively and scientifically, you begin to realize how difficult it is to prevent alcoholism, even to come to grips with some conception. Now, we know that secondary prevention is tremendously successful. We know our treatment programs. We know the kinds of things that DWI programs, really, in spite of the poo-pooing by, in many quarters, the evaluative research showed that many of these programs that intervened using the big stick of the license intervened in the earlier stages of the development of the disease. These are all secondary programs, of course. People already showing problems can be amazingly successful. The industrial alcoholism programs, from the Navy to our own impaired physician programs, every evidence seems to indicate that a dent is being made. The fetal alcohol syndrome, the most exciting conclusions can be come to, can be arrived at. We don't know how much good is done, but that good is being done by popularizing the fact to pregnant women that even one drink, you run a risk. Even though, again, lots of people will say, well, the level isn't known, and what do you want to do, scare all these pregnant women so that wouldn't it be worse for them to think that if their kids are born with some kind of defect that they were responsible and so on. I think one shouldn't be scared by some of these strictures, and one should forge ahead with every conceivable method of popularizing and awareness development about the fetal alcohol syndrome. It's too bad that it started so late. Maybe a lot of the defects would have been eliminated. Maybe a lot of the hyperactivity that's reported in research is coming out, that might be related in children, hyperactivity in children related to a mild fetal alcohol syndrome, etc. Of course, we also know that AA is the most successful treatment modality of intervention in its beautiful, consistent, ongoing kind of program that alters a way of life. And for me, AA is not only good for people who are already ill, who are beginning their recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous and the accessory fellowships like Al-Anon and Alateen, because it's a society, a family affair, really. But it's good for people like me and all others who aren't alcoholic. I can tell you that my drinking practice was interfered with as soon as I went to my first AA meeting, long before, and I hope I never developed the disease. But if only everybody could get to Alcoholics Anonymous and to be aware of their own lifestyle and their own relationships, their own interpersonal relationships, their own spiritual life, I think we can really make a far greater dent in the prevention of alcoholism than we've done so far. And one doesn't have to be discouraged by the failures in the past. because there's enough evidence of success all around us to really motivate us to continue. One of the things I think in conclusion I want to point out is how wasteful it is to have the kind of shotgun programs that fires into the air. One of the reasons for our failure in Maryland in our educational program, or the failures in other states, is because we hadn't focused on the high-risk groups. We have very little money, very little time available in medical schools and public school system. In our whole approach in living, we're involved with the boob tube and so on. The time we spend on constructive activities like preventive programs is limited. And we should focus very sharply with a rifle bullet on the high-risk groups. And of course, the children of alcoholics, to me, represents one of the highest risk groups that we have. Certainly, the fetal alcohol syndrome focuses on another high-risk group, pregnant women and even the child, a childbearing age woman. We've come to realize that aging people who've never had a problem with drinking, suddenly, in our culture, when age is looked down upon, we did a study in one of our state hospitals in the geriatric ward, where 50% of the men and women who were really social problems, not really psychotic or mental patients, but who were extruded from society by their families and needed a program like ours, because in those days there weren't many nursing homes. Lo and behold, we found that fully 50% of these men and women, and it was mainly clustered in the women, showed the development of alcoholism after the age of 65. They had never had a problem before. So that represents a very high-risk group, whether you're in a geriatric ward or living at home and lonely and feel rejected by your own family. I think we've learned that minorities, our own Native American population, blacks, other ethnic minorities, racial minorities, the rate of alcoholism there is much higher than in the rest of the population, and therefore we should be focusing on those. And of course, we've also learned that certain occupations, for some reason, and we don't have good research on why the doctors, we know that the availability of pills, of course, may well be a factor, but we don't know why house painters, and there seems to be evidence that they have a higher rate of alcoholism. There are theories, of course, about the exposure to fumes of turpentine and other mood-changing drugs, you might say, may be a factor. But there are many other occupations, salesmen, etc., that do represent higher risk groups, and I think programs ought to focus on them, and they've been neglected. Last thing I want to say, and very briefly, is that I think it's time for us to turn our attention to the liquor industry. I'm not talking about AA taking stands. I'm talking about us as private citizens, as members of agencies and groups where the liquor representation becomes part of alcoholism, so-called alcoholism programs. I was appalled at Rutgers only a few weeks ago when Riley Regan invited one of our good friends, a representative, the president of the U.S. Brewers Association, to lecture to his class on social issues. And I was appalled when bald-faced, it was stated that the brewers opposed the appropriation for NIAAA. They lobbied, and lobbied very successfully. You know how powerful such lobbies are in reducing the appropriation to NIAAA. And the reason this man gave was that it was a mismanaged agency. Well, fortunately, somebody in Riley's class raised his hand and said, you know, we've had occasions when the United States presidency was mismanaged. Did you lobby to eliminate that agency also? You know, he was a little embarrassed by that kind of question, but you can see behind this statement what the real interests of the liquor industry is. Even though they may be supporting a little research, they may be members of coalitions to prevent alcoholism and to support treatment programs, deep in my heart, I'm beginning to feel that we have to recognize who our friends are and who our enemies are, and take appropriate steps and take stands, and to disassociate ourselves and not lend aid and comfort to a great many of these agencies that behind our backs will really destroy us. Even though I know that there are beautiful ads in the newspapers by liquor industries, know when to say when and so on, but these things go only so far, and when push comes to shove, we have to recognize where they stand and where we have to stand. So I'm not discouraged after reading those 27 papers. I still have my Alcoholics Anonymous to fall back on, not only as a treatment modality. I couldn't exist as a physician treating alcoholics without having on my desk a list of sponsors that I use all the time, and without writing out a prescription for my alcoholic patients, Alcoholics Anonymous, with the address of a group for them to go to. But it's not only useful for treatment. I think the hope that AA gives us for prevention cannot be underestimated. Thank you. If anybody wants to see this list, you're welcome to it.